It's Friday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the UN Security Council meets over Turkey's military action in Syria.
The U.S. has not in any way endorsed the decision of the government of Turkey to mount a military incursion into northeast Syria.
Also ahead, Ukraine's president denies he was pressured to investigate President Trump's political rival. Two of Rudy Giuliani's associates are arrested for campaign finance fraud. The United States and China hold another round of trade talks, and the Nobel Prizes are handed out for literature. That's all on International Edition. Thanks for being with me on this Friday. I hope you're having a great day. Let's start off at the United Nations, where U.S. diplomats are pushing back on Turkey's incursion into northeastern Syria, labeling that military maneuver a very big mistake that could have significant consequences on the security situation in the region and beyond. The UN Security Council met Thursday to discuss the military operation, and it says that Turkey says it is a measured and responsible anti-terror operation. But the mainly Kurdish fighters in the region appealed for help to save our people from genocide. U.S. Ambassador Kelly Craft reiterated the Trump administration's stance that it has not endorsed Turkey's decision to invade northeastern Syria.
President Trump has emphasized to the government of Turkey that they bear full responsibility for protecting the Kurdish population and religious minorities, including Christians, and ensuring that no humanitarian crisis takes place.
Kraft also said that Turkey bears full responsibility for containing Islamic State fighters who have been imprisoned in Kurdish-held areas of northeastern Syria.
Turkey is now responsible for ensuring that all ISIS fighters in detention in prison remain in prison and that ISIS does not reconstitute itself in any way, shape, or form.
Germany's Deputy UN Ambassador Jürgen Schultz, speaking on behalf of the Security Council's five European members plus Estonia, which will join the Council next year, called on Turkey to cease hostile military operations.
Unilateral military action on Turkey's part threatens the progress achieved by the global coalition against Daesh. It will undermine the security of the coalition's local partners, including the Syrian Democratic Forces, and risks protracted instability in northeast Syria, providing fertile ground for the resurgence of Daesh, which remains a significant threat to regional, international, and European security.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Thursday that any military actions have to respect the UN Charter and humanitarian law.
Military operations must always respect the United Nations Charter and international humanitarian law. And I am particularly worried with the humanitarian concerns that exist now in relation to not only possible casualties, but meaningful displacement that is taking place.
Turkey launched its long-planned operation Wednesday with airstrikes, followed up by ground troops. Its defense ministry said in a statement Thursday that the operation continues successfully. In a letter to the United Nations, Turkey said its response would be proportionate, measured, and responsible. At the White House Thursday afternoon, President Donald Trump repeated his warning of tough economic sanctions if Turkey goes too far.
We had a big victory. We left the area. I don't think the American people want to see us go back in with our military, go back into that area again. We won. We left the area. I don't think we want to go back in. Let's see what happens. We are going to possibly do something very, very tough with respect to sanctions and other financial things.
Ankara is targeting Kurdish fighters it views as terrorists, but which most of the West considers to be key partners in the fight against militants from the so-called Islamic State group. The military operation began days after an unexpected and widely criticized White House announcement that U.S. forces would withdraw from the region. Humanitarian concerns are growing as Turkey's military incursion into northeastern Syria widens. Desperate civilians can be seen fleeing on tractors, trucks, and motorcycles, becoming the region's newest refugees. International and local aid agencies fear that hundreds of thousands of people could be at risk as Turkey launches airstrikes and pursues a ground offensive. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
Chaotic scenes are being repeated of frightened Kurdish, Syriac, Christian, and Yazidi civilians escaping on foot, carrying plastic bags with their worldly goods, while others are herded onto trucks or motorcycles enveloped in plumes of dust from the latest Turkish bombardment of their land. Roads are gridlocked with hundreds of fleeing families saying they don't know where to go for safety. The International Rescue Committee says that as the Turkish offensive in Syria begins, the IRC is deeply concerned about the lives and livelihoods of the 2 million civilians in northeast Syria, who have already survived ISIS brutality and multiple displacements, in a statement issued Thursday using an alternative reference for Islamic State. Catholic priest Father Emmanuel Yohanna, who runs Christian Aid Program Northern Iraq to help displaced Iraqis resulting from Islamic State attacks, told VOA from the Duhok region that he expects a wave of refugees from nearby northeastern Syria to flood into Iraq.
Peaceful region all over Syria. For years it has been this area of northeast Syria. Unfortunately, and painfully to say, we are expecting the worst. Definitely, the borders will be opened from Iraqi side to receive innocent civilians. We do expect mass waves of refugees.
Yohanna and other humanitarian responders say they are suspicious and critical of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's call for a so-called safe zone along the Turkish-Syrian border, where he plans to displace Kurds, Christians, and Yazidis, and move in 2 million Sunni Muslims from other parts of Syria.
Erdogan, this time targeting all the people except the terrorists. Actually, it is a demographic change policy.
Meanwhile, Iraq's Kurdistan Regional Government in Erbil says it does not have the capacity to accommodate all the people who are expected to be displaced as a result of the Turkish offensive. The Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces that had been backed by the U.S. until this week has called on the international community for assistance, saying the border areas of northeastern Syria are on the edge of a possible humanitarian catastrophe. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Among the top stories in the world, Ukrainian president says no blackmail in Trump call. Two Giuliani associates arrested for campaign finance fraud. NBA game played in China amid backlash over Hong Kong tweet. WHO says more than a billion people suffer preventable vision problems. And thousands view video of attack near German synagogue. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with me on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. VOA's International Edition continues. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said Thursday that there was no blackmail in his July phone call with U.S. President Donald Trump that is now at the center of an impeachment inquiry by the Democratic-led U.S. House of Representatives. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Zelensky spent several hours Thursday explaining that he didn't know military aid from the United States had been held up when he spoke with Trump by phone in July.
Ukraine's president finds himself at the center of an American political showdown. Volodymyr Zelensky was repeatedly questioned on whether U.S. President Donald Trump had blackmailed him in a July phone call by threatening to block U.S. military aid unless Kiev investigated the Ukraine business dealings of Hunter Biden, son of Trump's political rival, Joe Biden.
They blocked it even before we had the conversation, but we did not touch on it in our conversation. At that moment, I did not know about it. I talked to the Minister of Defense afterwards, and he said, we have a problem, they blocked that money. But when we were talking with Trump, this issue was not there at all. So there was no blackmail because it was not the subject of our conversation at all.
Zelensky was elected in April on a platform of rooting out corruption. Now the president is facing criticism over his own conduct, says Ilya Kusha, an analyst at the Ukrainian Institute of the Future.
It has become his first international diplomatic crisis.
Many Ukrainians believe Zelensky's account of his dealings with Trump, but there's still anger, says Kusha.
he allowed us to get involved in the American elections, and this is not the thing that we should have done, because we have plenty of our own problems, and trying to get into this process, it's a too global, too big game to play, and of course too risky one, because Ukraine here is just a gambling, you know, chip.
Paramount among those problems is the conflict with Russian-backed rebels in the east. President Zelensky called for international peacekeepers and has backed holding elections in the rebel-held Donbas region in return for political autonomy.
I have always said that if we are talking about people and territories, then people are the first priority and territories are the second priority.
Many Ukrainians fear the government is giving in to Russian aggression, and thousands took to the streets of Kiev Sunday to voice their anger.
We, the veterans, conflict participants, Maidan veterans, we came to say our categorical no to capitulation and everything that Zelensky does.
Zelensky is fighting multiple fronts, caught up in the political power play of Ukraine's major ally in the West and facing major opposition over his handling of the conflict in the East. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Kiev.
Meanwhile, at the White House Thursday, President Donald Trump maintained that his assertion that his conversation with Zelensky was, in his words, innocuous.
Well, I don't know how you can impeach on a conversation with the president of a country, in this case Ukraine, which was a perfect conversation, where the president of Ukraine just said there was no pressure put on him whatsoever, that we had an absolutely perfect conversation.
That conversation is at the center of an impeachment inquiry by three committees in the House of Representatives. House committees on Thursday subpoenaed Trump's Energy Secretary Rick Perry. House Democrats say that Perry may have reinforced the stark message that Trump conveyed to Zelensky. Perry says his only interest was to get Trump to talk to the Ukrainians on energy matters. According to a whistleblower complaint and a rough transcript of the July 25th call released by the White House, Trump urged Zelensky to open an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden, a leading contender for next year's Democratic Party nomination, to face Trump in the general election. The White House is refusing to participate in the impeachment inquiry, calling it unconstitutional. Meanwhile, two associates of President Donald Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, were arrested Thursday on federal charges of making hundreds of thousands of dollars in illegal contributions to Republican campaigns, including a pro-Trump super political action committee. Lev Parnas, a Ukrainian-born U.S. citizen, and Igor Fruman, a Belarusian-born U.S. citizen, were arrested by the FBI at Dulles International Airport outside Washington late Wednesday as they were set to depart the U.S. The two Florida-based businessmen, who allegedly lobbied for the ouster of a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine last year, were being sought by the House of Representatives impeachment investigators at the time of their arrest. Jeffrey Berman is the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York.
As alleged in the indictment, the defendants broke the law to gain political influence while avoiding disclosure of who was actually making the donations and where the money was coming from. They sought political influence not only to advance their own financial interests, but to advance the political interests of at least one foreign official, a Ukrainian government official who sought the dismissal of the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
According to the indictment, Parnas and Fruman used Global Energy Producers, a purported liquefied natural gas limited liability corporation, to contribute $235,000 to the Super PAC in May of 2018 and another $15,000 to a second political committee. Parnas gave $50,000 to Trump's 2016 election effort. A Facebook screen grab provided by the Campaign Legal Center shows Parnas with Trump at the White House in May of 2018. A second screenshot shows Parnas and Fruman with Donald Trump Jr., the president's eldest son, 3 weeks later. At the White House on Thursday, President Trump said he did not know any of the defendants.
I don't know those gentlemen. Now, it's possible I have a picture with them because I have a picture with everybody. I have a picture with everybody here. But somebody said there may be a picture or something where at a fundraiser or somewhere. But I have pictures with everybody.
The charges against the pair stem from a Federal Election Commission complaint filed last year by an independent watchdog that claimed the men set up a shell company in order to anonymously funnel foreign money to the pro-Trump, that is, super PAC called America First Action. William F. Sweeney, Jr. is the FBI's New York field office assistant director in charge.
This investigation is about corrupt behavior, deliberate lawbreaking. The FBI takes the obligation to tackle corruption seriously. There are no exceptions to this rule. We gather evidence, we collect facts, and we will act on them when appropriate.
U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Berman says that protecting the integrity of U.S. elections is paramount.
Protecting the integrity of our elections and protecting our elections from unlawful foreign influence are core functions of our campaign finance laws. And as this office has made clear, we will not hesitate to investigate and prosecute those who engage in criminal conduct that draws into question the integrity of our political process.
Two other defendants, Ukrainian-born Andrei Kukushkin and American-born David Correa, also named in the indictment in connection with a separate campaign finance violation scheme, have been arrested in California, but Correa remains at large. U.S. and Chinese negotiators departed a 13th round of talks Thursday aimed at ending a 15-month-old trade war that is worrying global investors and weighing on the world economy. Chinese Vice Premier Liu He led a delegation into meetings in Washington with U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. At the White House, President Trump said the talks were going well and will continue later today.
We just completed a negotiation with China. We're doing very well. We're having another one tomorrow. I'm meeting with the Vice Premier over at the White House, and I think it's going really well.
VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Doug Barry of the U.S.-China Business Council. He said that neither side is likely to get everything they want.
It sounds as if both sides are moving closer to an announcement of some kind of a deal. The deal is going to be smaller than some people had hoped, but a deal of any kind is more than a lot of skeptics had felt. And so the parameters of the deal look like that there was some movement and progress on the protection of intellectual property enforcement, which has long been a concern of the U.S. business community. It looks like there could be an announcement about purchases of agricultural products. The Minister of Agriculture from China is part of the delegation in town here today. And there could be some further opening of sectors in the Chinese economy that had been closed or somewhat closed and restricted to U.S. business people, and some movement in an agreement on how to manage the currency. U.S. side has complained that the Chinese have been a currency manipulator, so they've been talking about that for quite some time, and it sounds like the Chinese will make some kind of statement about the importance of keeping the Chinese yuan strong. And in return for that, the Chinese are asking, we've heard, for some relief on the tariff side. And indeed, there probably will be some, but most of the tariffs that have been imposed in four stages, with the fourth scheduled for December the 15th, will probably remain in place until the U.S. side sees some progress on the implementation of whatever it is that's agreed to.
Why do you think the U.S. is taking such a hard stand on this?
Well, there are a lot of people in the administration that are hardliners, and they would prefer to be less dependent on China for everything. And they would certainly like the economies to be separated in some way. It's often referred to as decoupling. So we're not going to see those forces go away, at least for the foreseeable future. But the moderates appear to be prevailing, at least this week, whether it's Hong Kong or Uyghurs or the NBA comment, delisting of Chinese financial institutions or the threat thereof, and blacklisting. All of these things have just added to the drama. But what's surprising is that the two sides have, at least for the moment anyway, put aside some of those more difficult issues and seem to be focusing on a short-term win here.
What is stopping the two sides from reaching an agreement that would be beneficial to both sides?
Well, I think one of the issues for the Trump administration has been how the politics of the trade negotiations and the politics of a partial agreement as opposed to a more fulsome one that was in the mix as of last May, but the Chinese walked away from it. And then we've had these months of uncertainty. On the U.S. side, President Trump will have to sell this as a victory nevertheless. It's a partial win, and it's going to make the farmers whole, who are an important constituency to him. It's going to take some of the tariffs perhaps off, which will be a welcome sign for consumers, and that it opens the door for a more comprehensive agreement on some of these more difficult subjects, such as the structural aspects of the Chinese economy that the U.S. business community is hoping the Chinese will address at some point in the future. On the Chinese side, President Xi Jinping of China is also worried about the reaction of his constituencies to this. They didn't like the first agreement that was scuttled back in May, and so he's hoping that they will like this one, and he probably will sell it to his public as we've been working to have an agreement, we've been working to open our economy further. We've done so, and we're glad the U.S. is at least partly satisfied with it. We'll continue to do so, as has always been our plan. We're not being pressured or bullied into doing it.
That's Doug Barry of the U.S.-China Business Council speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Coming up, we'll hear who won the Nobel Prizes for Literature. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, two Nobel Prizes are awarded for literature. Thursday was World Mental Health Day. It's held every October 10th to raise awareness about mental health issues. As part of that, the International Committee of the Red Cross called for greater psychosocial support for millions of people caught in violence and armed conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
A survey finds more than 1 in 5 people in conflict-affected areas live with a mental health condition ranging from depression and anxiety to post-traumatic stress. That is 3 times more than the general population worldwide. Despite the growing problem, the International Committee of the Red Cross says mental health conditions among people subjected to war and violence are generally overlooked. It warns the hidden wounds will have long-term, even life-threatening impacts if left untreated. Ida Anderson is ICRC lead psychologist for Africa. She works with people in crisis in countries such as Nigeria, the Central African Republic, Burundi, and South Sudan. She says people exposed to extreme violence often have sleep disorders, including insomnia or nightmares. Some suffer from schizophrenia, become overly aggressive, or have suicidal tendencies. She tells VOA on Skype from Nairobi that mental health needs for victims of war are as important as water, food, and shelter. She says therapeutic help must be part of an integrated response.
Mental health and psychosocial needs need to be considered along with other needs, and the response to them should occur simultaneously. It's about providing what is needed as soon as it is needed.
Anderson says talking about problems is what works best with adults in distress. Drawing, however, works best with children.
We carry out these mental health and psychosocial interventions where we use drawings as a way of allowing the child to express him or herself. These children have oftentimes experienced terrible violence that they barely have a vocabulary to talk about. And through the drawing, they are able to express a lot of this.
The Red Cross is calling for increased recognition of the mental health consequences of humanitarian crises. It says investing in mental health and psychosocial support saves lives. Such investment also reaps economic benefits in post-conflict environments. It notes every dollar invested in treatment for depression can lead to a $5 return in better health. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Austrian poet Peter Handke won the 2019 Nobel Prize for Literature, and the postponed 2018 award went to Polish author Olga Tokarczuk, the Swedish Academy said on Thursday. We get details from Reuters correspondent Megan Ravel.
Austrian poet Peter Handke has won the 2019 Nobel Prize for Literature.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2019 is awarded to the Austrian author Peter Handke for an influential work that with linguistic ingenuity has explored the periphery and the specificity of human experience.
The 76-year-old was praised for being one of the most influential post-war writers in Europe, with work spanning novels, essays, notebooks and dramatic works.
I was astonished, yes. It was very courageous by the Swedish Academy. This kind of decision.
The postponed 2018 award went to Polish author Olga Tokarczuk.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2018 is awarded to the Polish author Olga Tokarczuk for a narrative imagination that with encyclopedic passion represents the crossing of boundaries as a form of life.
Tokarczuk trained as a psychologist before publishing her first novel in 1993. Her novel, Flight, won the Man Booker International Prize last year, making her the first Polish author to do so.
In the beginning I was surprised, but now I'm starting to, I'm trying to verbalize this idea that Olga Tokarczuk is related to Nobel Prize. It's still quite difficult for me to understand, but of course I'm from the other side, I'm proud and I'm very aware that my life changed.
Last year's prize was delayed by a year after a sexual assault scandal rocked the Academy.
That's Megan Ravel of Reuters. The Nobel Peace Prize is the next one to be announced later today. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. And thank you. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your day.
This is VOA News. I'm